Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Over Independence Day weekend, an ExxonMobil pipeline ruptured under the Yellowstone River in Montana, dumping 42,000 gallons of crude oil into the river and onto one of the most storied names in the American West, Yellowstone. The national park is upstream and safe, but a flood-stage Yellowstone River is taking that spilled oil far and wide and lighting up tensions over booming energy production and land use issues in the West. This hour on Point, we're going to the Yellowstone. You can join the conversation. Is this just the price we have to pay for oil? Have you seen the drilling and production boom in the West? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll hear in a few moments from Montana Governor Brian Schweitzer. But first, a couple of bits of sound from over the weekend as all this news came tumbling out. Oil spill in the Yellowstone River. In a conference call on the 4th of July, Monday, ExxonMobil Pipeline Company President Gary Prusing said the company was putting more resources into responding to the spill.
We understand this is a very serious event. We understand that we need to get our full arms around where the exposure areas are. We have not fully completed that yet, so we continue to look downstream to make sure that we've identified all the areas that we need to address.
Not easy with the Yellowstone River at flood stage, running very high and very hard. Montana Fish, Wildlife and Parks wildlife manager Ray Mule said animals could die from contact with the oil.
Birds obviously can get away. Deer and other animals can move away. The aquatic ecosystem is probably going to be a much more difficult thing to assess because you've got all these aquatic invertebrates that are living in this water, and they form the food basis, the food chain for all the fish.
And rivers, of course, flow, taking that oil right now with the river as it goes. Joining us right now from Billings, Montana, is Rob Rogers, a reporter for the Billings Gazette. He's been on the scene covering the Yellowstone River spill. Rob, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
So what's the latest here on exactly what happened, Rob? There's some news this morning about what was reported when, about how long this spill went on.
Yeah, initially reports from Exxon were that, after engineers noticed a loss of pressure in the pipeline, that from that point it took them 6 minutes to start the shutdown process. And initially they were saying that in all, from start to stop, it took about 30 minutes. And then the AP was able to get documents from the U.S. Department of Transportation, which, oversees pipeline, which showed that it was closer to 49 minutes that it took from start to stop, so almost twice as long as Exxon had initially said.
And minutes matter here because it's a volume of oil escaping in every minute that it's pumping.
Exactly, and they pointed out repeatedly yesterday that the oil, because of its mass, its density, you just can't stop in a pipeline. It's something that has to be slowly brought to a halt, and then of course once it is stopped, there's still residual oil left in the pipeline that continues to leach out as the water in the river pulls it out of the pipe.
Rob, you've been out there a good bit since the spill. Take us to the Yellowstone River. First, give us a sense of how it flows from where to where, and then this pipeline, where is it going from and to, and where do they meet?
Well, the Yellowstone River obviously gets its name from the park. It flows from Wyoming into Montana. It's on the east side of the Continental Divide, so it flows east, and it flows north,
To the Missouri.
To the Missouri, passes up into North Dakota, where it meets with the Missouri River.
Mm-hmm.
The pipeline is called the Silvertip Pipeline, and it comes from Exxon's oil fields in northern Wyoming, and carries, I think it's 40,000 barrels a day from those fields in northern Wyoming to Exxon's refinery in Billings.
And that refinery, is it a big one?
It is a big one. It's one of the main refineries they have in North America, and it processes a lot of oil for the company.
So where the pipeline intersects with the river, what's that look like? Is it above ground before it gets there? And then I take it it's buried under the river.
It is buried under the river. It was built about 20 years ago, and they, as is the custom, Governor Schweitzer, Brian Schweitzer, pointed out yesterday that there's 88 places in Montana where oil and gas pipes pass under, you know, major bodies of water in the state. But it passes under the Yellowstone before making kind of a 90-degree turn heading east to Billings. And it's interesting, you know, initially the pipe was believed to be maybe 7-8 feet under the riverbed itself. Mm-hmm. In May, they shut the pipe down for a day to do some tests. That's when we first started having flood stages on the Yellowstone River. And for the day, they shut it down. They did some stress tests, and Exxon believed that whatever was going to come this summer in terms of floodwaters, that the pipe would be able to withstand it. At that point, the pipe was about 5 to 7 feet under the ground, under the riverbed.
Oh, and what's it look like? What's the terrain where the pipeline crosses the river? Is this wooded? Is it populated? Is it farmed right there or not?
It's not very populated. It's about 10 miles south of Billings. It's ranch and farm country. The Absaroka Beartooth Mountains are about 60 miles east of it. So it's low, flat land, grassland, surrounded by mountains on 2 and 3 sides.
And in the flood stage there right now, I mean, I guess we've seen all the way down the Missouri the impact of that, and the enormous flooding that we've seen in the Dakotas and right on down. But the Yellowstone River would be one of the feeders feeding into that.
Exactly, and it's been at flood stage a couple times. It was at 14 feet on Saturday, which is just above flood stage. It was cresting yesterday, and you have to imagine, you know, once a river gets above flood stage, it then passes out of its banks and begins to pool in the low line lands along the banks of the river, and because it's flood stage, I mean, this water is it's snow melt. It's coming down from the mountains, and so it's moving quickly. It's very murky, carrying a lot of sediment and a lot of debris, a lot of trees and limbs. We're talking, you know, 16-inch cottonwoods that it'll carry along.
So it's hard to get in there and deal with this, hard to fix things, hard to assess even the damage. But if it's that high and moving that fast and hard, that means it's spreading the oil very widely as well right now, Rob.
Exactly, and that's been one of the problems is that, it carried the initial load very quickly and the water then disperses the oil, and so it begins to collect in these backwaters, in these eddies and sticks to the side and pools where the water isn't flowing so much because it just kind of sits there as the flood pushes it into the plains.
We're going to hear in a few minutes from the governor of Montana, Brian Schweitzer, but I want to get the view from right along the river and its tributaries. Alexis Bonagowski joins us now. Her farm is about 10 miles downstream from the Yellowstone spill. Alexis, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Describe where your property sits in relation to the Yellowstone River and what are you seeing of the spill?
Our property lies right on the Yellowstone River. It's a fairly narrow piece of land, but it goes along the Yellowstone River for quite a while. Our farm has an amazing amount of wetlands and ponds and sloughs that when the river flooded, the oil spill happened about the same time. And so all of that oil ended up, you know, coming into our property, onto our pastures, our summer pastures, our hay fields, and into the wetlands that we have on our place. It is pretty devastating.
What does it look like there now, Alexis? Or what does it smell like? Or you paint the picture for us.
The smell was overwhelming. That's actually how I found out about it. No one warned us. I woke up on Saturday morning at about 7:30 and walked down to do chores, let the goats out into the pastures, and I got this overwhelming smell of hydrocarbons. You could hardly breathe down there. And I checked our local paper real quick on my phone and found that there had been an oil spill, and that's how I knew. Right now we have globs of oil, you know, in our waterways, our sloughs. Where the water has receded, the topsoil is shiny with oil. There's plants covered in oil. The shoreline has oil all over it. It's devastating.
Now, this is a big agricultural production region in addition to being an oil production and refining region. Mm-hmm. Cattle, sheep, corn, wheat, sugar beets. But this, in the Yellowstone Valley, it all depends on the river. This is irrigated agriculture.
It is. And that's what I'm, you know, most worried about is that we have so much along the Yellowstone River. Everyone relies so much on it. You know, my, you know, over half my land right now, I can't run my animals on it. They're all up by my house and pastures. And I, you know, I don't know about other landowners. I know that people are probably still finding where there's oil on their pastures, on their hay fields, and I don't think the full extent of the damage has been assessed yet.
I know you also work with the National Wildlife Federation. I mean, are you worried about the balance of conservation and energy production in your part of the country these days?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we rely on the Yellowstone River. It is so important to us for drinking water, for our agricultural production. That's the number one industry in our state is agriculture. I think we do need to look at these issues and see, is this, are we willing to have these catastrophic events that affect ecosystems for hundreds of miles and the water systems that, that farmers and ranchers rely on to have their, you know, for their livelihoods? And, you know, right now on our farm, the wildlife, you know, are gone from the area where there's a spill. We don't hear the birds, we don't hear the toads or the amphibians or the fish, and it's just, it's devastating to walk down there. And, you know, I grew up there, so I know that place, and everything's changed.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Yellowstone oil spill, a ruptured pipeline. 1,000 barrels of oil, we're told, in the Yellowstone River, and how it lights up energy and land use issues in the American West. We've been joined by Rob Rogers with the Billings Gazette, reporter who's been all over this story along the river there, by Alexis Bonagofsky, who lives out along the Yellowstone River, owner of Blue Creek Farms there, about 10 miles downstream from the site of the pipeline rupture. And you heard her description of what she's seen there already. Right now with us from Helena, Montana, the governor of Montana, Brian Schweitzer joins us, the first Democrat to serve as Montana's governor in 20 years. He was out yesterday touring the oil spill. Governor Schweitzer, thank you very much for being with us. What did you see?
Well, touring makes it sound like I was on vacation.
No, I don't think so. We know it wasn't.
I saw the Yellowstone River, the largest undammed river in the United States, at full glory. It's at full crest. The Beartooths and the Bzorkies, they're releasing their water from the snowmelt high in the Rocky Mountains. And that river is roaring through Laurel and Billings. I heard Rob say something about 16-inch cottonwoods. I saw a cottonwood tree that was probably closer to 30 inches in diameter with all of its leaves and all of its branches moving down the river yesterday that looked like an island.
Powerful river at flood stage, but hard to say full glory when it's got a big oil spill right now.
Well, the river itself's at full glory. ExxonMobil, not so much. I got to tell you, very early on, there were those who said, oh, it's a good thing that the river's so high because the solution to pollution is dilution. But Rob had it exactly right. Since the river was cresting at the same time that this oil leak occurred, minute quantities of water were going over the tops of the banks and working their way into some of these lowland areas, these important critical habitat areas that only get water once every 5 or 10 years, and they are a treasure trove of biotics, of microbes that feed insects that feed reptiles, and reptiles that are part of the ecosystem in the river. And so the river crested over the top, and as you know, and everybody in America knows, oil floats on water.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a higher concentration of oil that went into these eddies. Now the water has receded, some of the water has infiltrated, and we're left with the oil globules at the surface. Look, that is just an indicator. When people see that black goo, they say, oh my God, well, that's bad. But that's an indicator so that we can get in and clean it up. What about all the places where there was just an oil sheen and now it is infiltrated a quarter inch into the soil, and we won't know about it in the future? My concern is that ExxonMobil says, well, that's it. We've got her all fixed. And EPA, well, they find another problem someplace else and they go on down the road. But Montana is the client here. And Montana will decide when this Yellowstone River is cleaned up, not some bureaucrats from Washington, D.C., and certainly not ExxonMobil and their shareholders.
What do you make of ExxonMobil's, first of all, pipeline maintenance in this case and of their response to the spill so far, Governor?
There seems to be a fair bit of evidence that ExxonMobil is known for at least a year that the integrity of this Silvertip pipeline was in question. They were questioned by the mayor of Laurel. They were questioned by federal pipeline officials. And so this probably didn't come as such a big surprise to them. But what does come as a big surprise to me is that they didn't take action. And, you know, in my first meetings with ExxonMobil and my discussions with them when they landed from Houston, Texas, is, look, I'm going to be square with you, and I'm going to be a hands-on governor with this reclamation effort. Tell me the truth. Tell me early. If I hear something that you didn't tell me first, if you weren't square with me, then we're going to lose a relationship. Well, we lost that relationship during the first 12 hours when they said, well, it's only gone 10 miles downstream. Really, 10 miles? The river's flowing at 7
right.
miles per hour,
yeah.
And this only made it 10 miles downstream. And then they said the very first day, and the Billings Gazette, God bless them, had some pictures. They said no wildlife was affected. So the Billings Gazette showed a turtle and a bird that were completely inundated in oil. But ExxonMobil, this ain't their first rodeo. They know exactly what to do. They made the stalking horse. Well, how many birds can you find? So far, they found a pelican, a duck, and a turtle, and everybody's having a big laugh.
But
well, it's not about the macrobiotics. It's about the microbiotics. It's about the soil quality. It's about these microbes and the insects. So let's not take our eye off the ball in terms of what's important for the health of that river.
Governor Brian Schweitzer of Montana is with us. And Governor, we've got one of your constituents who lives and farms along the river with us, Alice Bonagovsky. They're from Blue Creek Farms. And Alexis, I wonder, here's the governor. He says he's breathing down the neck of ExxonMobil here on cleanup and sticking with it. What's your question, or what do you want to put to the governor, Alexis?
I'm just happy he's here. I've been happy with what he's been saying, and I think that, you know, I'm afraid that when the national media leaves that, you know, Exxon's going to go with them, and I'm just, you know, happy to hear that he's going to be on them until this is cleaned up, because I know, you know, all of the oil on our place is inland. It's, you know, a quarter mile in, if not further, and he's right about the, you know, there's places where there's just a sheen that unless you walk down that river and find those places, you're not going to see it from the air. So.
Well, Alexi, I think you make a very good point. When I came into Billings, I actually, you know, the plane I fly in is about the size of a Maytag washing machine with wings. Mm. And so we went low over the river, and we flew from about Lockwood up to the refinery and back. And I've been hearing from ExxonMobil, they've been flying the river, and we don't see any evidence on downstream. Hell, I couldn't even see any evidence on top of the place where people were cleaning it up, let alone downstream. I've told them from the beginning, you got to have boots on the ground and boats on the river. Every square foot of this Yellowstone River needs to be inspected, and needs to be inspected soon.
Governor Schweitzer, let me ask you, though, and I know we've just got you for another minute here, but I mean, you've been a big champion of clean and green American energy. If I go to your website, your biography, though, one of the things you brag on, if I may put it that way, is Montana being, it says that the state is one of only a few states in the country to have increased oil production since 2004. So you're bragging about increasing oil production. At the same time, you've got oil down your Yellowstone River. Now, is there a contradiction there or not?
No, there's not a contradiction. This country needs energy, and if we don't develop energy domestically, whether it's wind or solar or clean coal or oil, if we're not developing that energy here, we're developing it in the Middle East or in Venezuela, and I am absolutely sure that I'll never have to send the Montana National Guard to the oil fields in Montana or the border with Alberta to protect our energy supply, and we've got the National Guard in both Iraq and Afghanistan today. So we're going to continue to develop energy in Montana. We're an energy state, but we will not be a sacrifice zone for this energy's needs. We will develop this energy on our terms. We will protect the landscape and the wildlife of Montana for this generation and future generations, and that energy that we develop in Montana will be developed on our terms.
Governor Brian Schweitzer, Governor of Montana. Governor, thanks very much for being with us
today.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us. Rob Rogers with the Billings Gazette. What do you know about what ExxonMobil is promising on the cleanup? Does it square with what the governor is demanding there?
Well, on the face, it does. They've brought in about 360 folks to begin the cleanup yesterday. They had about 200 people on the ground, and you know, within the first 18, 19 miles from the site of the spill downstream, you've got crews, you know, clad in white, wearing life vests lest they slip into the river, mopping up pockets of oil with pads, with these big tubes that they call booms. And they've certainly been busy since Saturday when the first crews started to arrive out of Houston.
We're going to hear from – get an environmentalist view of what's going on here in a moment. If I may, first let's bring our listeners in a little bit. We've got Rex calling from Salt Lake City out in the Mountain West. It's great to have you, Rex. Thank you very much. What do you know?
Hi, Tom. Well, recently we had an oil spill in my neighborhood that went down a creek that is in a residential area.
Okay.
And I found the EPA to be very helpful. I own a home in that area, and I just rent. And I think what local officials do in the Mountain West is they always want to say the federal government bad and state good. And I don't think that's the case. I think they ought to work as a team.
So in your
spill is never cleaned up.
Yeah, in your case, Rex, it was the EPA that came and did the cleanup work, not an oil company or a production.
No, the oil company did the cleanup.
Okay, but EPA oversaw it.
Standard, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
And the EPA oversaw it, but they did a good job overseeing the local and the federal and the state. They worked as a team.
And you were glad to have everybody on it. I appreciate that report from Salt Lake. Let me go to – and thanks, Rex. Let me go to David in Chesapeake, Virginia. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I was – you know, I've been listening to all of this. I'm kind of surprised that more people aren't calling in and just going irate off on Exxon. But, you know, they're not the only company that's – you know, in my opinion, they're just totally gross negligence of all the things that they do in this country. The fact that this pipeline has caused this issue should have never happened. I mean, if they care, you know, they talk the talk, but they don't.
David, do you have expertise in this issue? I mean, how do you know that they're grossly?
Yes. I've worked in the regulatory industry and inspection pipeline industry for about 20 years.
I'm now
a consultant. I used to work for the federal government.
Yeah.
And, you know, as the person called a second ago, the feds are trying to jump on this as much as they can. They're getting a lot of flack from the industry for doing it. But you know, they have this thing called a smart ball, and the smart ball, they send down a pipeline, and it basically creates a sonar, has a sonar within it, and it sends back all the information back.
Is that what they call a pig? Also, David, that they send down the okay.
Yes, that's true, and so you know, by sending a smart ball down there, they can totally analyze the pipeline and it tells them everything they want to know about it. And you know, one of the things they could have done if they knew that there was issues, you know, they could have shut it down, installed a valve, or you know, done whatever they needed to do necessary, or even taken the oil that you know would have had to be say shut down for a little bit and just barged it in, or however else they needed to reroute it. But their excuses is that it's costing them time, it's costing them money, blah blah blah. But then look what happens in the end result.
Yeah,
these companies always use the same excuse by saying, "Well, it's you know, they you know, it's almost like the energy thing, like this guy was saying before. You know, energy, energy, energy. It's almost like a religion to them. They're so brainwashed with it. But yet, where are they putting in the measures to help with fixing these problems?"
David, we've got it. We need the energy, but what energy? And if it's going to be fossil fuels, how careful are we going to be? I appreciate that call. Let me get one more here from Indiana. Elberfeld, Indiana. Thomas, you're on the air.
This is Tom. I'm curious. We lay natural gas pipelines, and whenever we cross a river, we have to put a casing in and then put the pipeline inside the casing so that if a leak develops, it goes into the casing, not into the river.
Sounds good.
I don't understand why this pipeline wasn't cased.
Great question, Tom. Thanks for your call. Rob Rogers in Billings, do you know, was there casing here? Is that required? Was it there?
I don't think there was casing there, and I think that's what caused the problem. But again, we don't know. The pipe itself was installed, I believe, roughly 20 years ago, and so I don't know if maybe regulations since then have changed. Exxon made a point yesterday in saying that that when they go in and repair the pipe and replace that section, that they'll use newer technology that apparently pipeline companies are using these days to bury it 25 feet under the riverbed to avoid catastrophes like this.
But meanwhile, it's a little late for this stretch. We don't know how long. How long, Rob? Where are people reporting oil from this? How far downstream are they cleaning up or watching?
Well, the worst of it seems to be in the first 15-18 miles down the river. They've found and confirmed one more spot 24 miles downstream. But like the governor said, with the river moving as fast as it is, and with all the water spreading into overgrowth, it's really hard to know until people get out on their property and start investigating and scoping out to see where these pockets of oil are. But so far, 24 miles downstream is the last confirmed spot where they've seen oil.
Rob Rogers with the Billings Gazette joining us today from Billings, Montana. Rob, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Alexis Bonagoski, please stand by. Joining us right now from Helena, Montana, is Jim Jensen. He's Executive Director of the Montana Environmental Information Center. Long history in state government in the EPA under Presidents George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. He's on the steering committees of the Western Clean Energy Campaign and the Northwest Climate Connections. Jim Jensen, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. You're very welcome.
What do you see in this spill, Jim? What's the lesson we ought to be taking here?
Well, the primary lesson is that we need a federal policy that moves us away from fossil fuels to renewable energy. The truth is that no wind turbine or solar collector has ever befouled a river. And it is a failure of the Congress and I think a failure of leadership of the Obama administration that has gotten us at this point, has failed to move forward on a serious energy policy for the country that moves us away from fossil fuels. As long as we're going to be using oil and gas and have this false sense that we can somehow be energy secure or independent in this country and therefore open more lands, wild, beautiful spaces in the West in particular, and our offshore regions to oil and gas development, we're going to continue to have this kind of spill or leak. It seems to be unavoidable. Of course, Exxon is the poster child. It seems to me I would describe them as the Whitey Bulger of the polluting corporations of America.
They say they're going to come in and do it right, Jim. Maybe put in the casing.
Well, they've never done it right yet. I was just in Alaska 2 months ago talking with folks up there. Subsequent, impacts from the Exxon Valdez. They've never paid reparations. They've fought them hammer and tongue through the courts. And it's interesting that Governor Schweitzer talks about, sort of out of both sides of his mouth on this, that we're going to develop energy in Montana. Oil and gas is great, and he's just returned from a trade mission to China promoting the sale of coal, Montana coal to China. And just 2 weeks ago had a well-publicized meeting here in Helena with ExxonMobil executives. And the result of that was telling us that we should trust them to haul these massive loads of equipment from up the Snake River, up the Lauksaw River in Idaho, and then the Blackfoot River in Montana into Alberta, where they're developing this massive, hideous tar sands extraction site.
And a lot of equipment headed up through Montana to help that happen in very, very huge scale equipment.
That's right. And the governor says, oh, that's fine. He is a short skirt cheerleader for that project.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the Yellowstone oil spill, a ruptured pipeline, 1,000 barrels, we're told, of oil in the Yellowstone River, and how it lights up energy and land use issues in the American West. Heard a little earlier in the hour from the governor of Montana, Brian Schweitzer. With us right now from Billings is Alexis Bonagowski, owner of Blue Creek Farms, about 10 miles downstream from the site of the pipe rupture. She's seen plenty of evidence right there on her farm along the banks of the river. With us as well from Helena, Montana, is Jim Jensen. He served under President George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton as an advisor to the EPA. Now he is executive director of the Montana Environmental Information Center. We've got some vivid response online here. Roger says, "Drill, baby, drill. How much does Exxon pay in royalties to the U.S. for the privilege of sucking oil out of the ground? Have the royalty charges risen over time to reflect inflation in the cost of energy? Shouldn't the punitive fines be significant enough to force these despoilers to improve their ecological behavior? But heaven forbid, talking about taxing these job creators." A little zing there. Sangzi says, "I find it outrageous that it should be suggested that the defiling of the environment is the necessary price we have to pay for oil. Spills like the one corrupting Montana should never happen." And yet we see them happen again and again when, as Jim Jensen says, we're going after those fossil fuels. Bruce in Luray, Virginia. Bruce, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Imagine if you and I had waste oil and we decided that the easiest way to dispose of it was to dump it into the Yellowstone River. Could you imagine how many minutes it would take before you and I would be incarcerated for such a stunt?
Not
and
many.
Yet, no. And yet the executives of oil industries, oil businesses, see this as just the cost of doing business. With such astronomical profits, they can afford to pay whatever negligible fines are doled out. So I think that there need to be criminal penalties for oil executives. The BP executives got off scot-free, and there was plenty of evidence of gross negligence in their case.
Yeah, it's been raised before, criminal penalties, but fat chance. I mean, that these people have a lot of influence, and there is just a view that if you want this, and Jim Jensen kind of alludes to it, that if you're going to have fossil fuels, they're going to be dirtier than if you've got clean energy. I mean, Alexis, how do you look at this? It's your farm and other farmers all around you. Do you feel like this land is protected by enough deterrence in the law for the oil company to keep it, you know, really on top of what's going on with the flow of oil?
Well, even if we do have the best laws on the books, they mean nothing unless they're enforced. And that's what you find all over the West right now is we have good laws in Montana, but they're not being enforced. People are not monitoring them. We do not have enough state resources, and people choose to move, you know, resources in our state to other places. So, yeah, we have great laws, but it doesn't mean anything because, you know, no one's enforcing them. And so, you know, I never thought this would happen to me personally. I help other people deal with this, and it's pretty devastating. And I started to realize how, when it happened to me, how isolating it is to be someone impacted. You know, Exxon has been nothing but talking points, and I just don't have time for that. I'm tired of it. We had to track down these people to get answers. The local agency, I called them on Saturday morning, and I got an answering machine, the emergency services agency. The handling of this the last, you know, 4 days has been abysmal.
Jim, you know, we saw this effort by the Obama administration. There was the big announcement more than a year ago that they were going to step in and protect 11 million of acres of land in the West as wildlands. And then in the big budget compromise that we saw earlier this year, there's a writer in there denying any funding for that, and it's all called off. Bruce Babbitt, the former Secretary of the Interior under Bill Clinton, has come out very critical of the House. He says, big speech at the National Press Club recently said the Congress, led by the House, has declared war on our land, water, and natural resources, and very critical of President Obama, saying step up and let's be tougher in protecting our natural resources there. What do you see going on, Jim?
Well, I think Secretary Babbitt has hit it on the head. There is no real leadership from the administration to educate and defend about these western wildlands. These are some of the most precious lands and have in the country. And all the way back to Teddy Roosevelt's courageous use of the Antiquities Act to set aside millions of acres to be protected from the rapacious industries of the time that wanted to essentially privatize all the public resources. And President Obama has simply not acted. He has not led on these issues. I get back to the failure to move on a serious global warming or climate policy bill. Senator Cantwell, Maria Cantwell from Washington State, has a terrific bill called the CLEAR Act, which failed in the last Congress, frankly, because the administration simply wasn't willing to lend any of its political capital for it. And Senator Cantwell is moving again, introducing her bill into this Congress. It's got tougher sledding this time, but she's a true leader and is working on this, and I wish that the administration would do the same thing. Of course, the actions by the current Secretary of Interior Salazar to withdraw all of these proposed wildland protection areas recently just shows that they're going absolutely in the wrong direction.
You know, Jim, I think a lot of Americans may not have quite the picture of how much energy drilling has boomed, how much infrastructure there is now in the American West. We think of it as sort of just open spaces and wild places, but the last decade or so, I'm reading it, there's just been a huge boom. People flying over describing, you know, it looks kind of like a factory zone in many areas.
Oh, absolutely. It's been especially the case with the development of something called coal bed methane, where just dramatic landscape level oil and gas drilling in some of the most remote and beautiful areas of the West, in Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, and Montana in particular, are no longer the classic quiet places with wildlife and ranching living side by side. They have been turned in literally into massive industrial zones. In the Uinta Basin, for example, in eastern Utah, has the worst air quality in the United States. That is all because of oil and gas development and a failure to regulate that development in that historic oil and gas region. I mean, the Green River, John Leslie Powell's trip went right through the heart of it, and desolation and Gray's Canyons. You have all of that going on. And to the EPA's serious credit, the region headquartered in Denver has taken strong action recently in Utah, in that area, to try to bring this situation to an end. But it is the case that many places in the West are being despoiled. And this is the public domain that is owned by every American, not for the public. It's not the private dominion of oil and gas interests.
Jim Jensen, stand by there in Helena and Alexis in Billings, Montana. I want to welcome into our conversation from Aspen, Colorado, Philip Verliger. He's been our guest before, founder of PK Verliger. It's an economics and energy consulting firm. He's a professor at the University of Calgary's Haskayne School of Business. Has followed this industry and advised it for a long, long time. Philip Verliger, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me. And let me echo what was said earlier about the West. I live out here a little south. Mm-hmm. But if you fly out here and you spend any time out here, what has happened is awful. It's simply awful.
What do you mean when you say that? If I'm flying, what do I see?
What you see is, instead of open space, trees and so on, now you see pockmarks from 40,000 feet, just area after area after area where drilling, they've come in and put drilling pads and they're drilling. And it's as if, you know, the whole skin, the whole area has some sort of skin disease from, say, 40,000 feet is what it looks like. And it really is, it's not necessary. And the thing is, it takes hundreds of years for the soil out here to recover, especially down in Colorado, because we get so little water.
But when I look at the record of your work, Philip Verliger, I mean, back in 2004, you were warning that U.S. environmental regulations would cause crude oil prices to rise to what was seemed then very high, $60 a barrel.
Absolutely. But you know what? And my point has been, mm-hmm. and interesting, you know, we don't need to drill. What we need is investment in capacity to convert heavy sour crude oils to diesel fuels, the fuels we use that have no sulfur in them. No
pollution. What would be the advantage of this? How do you get that without drilling?
We have plenty of crude oil right now. We can't refine it. It is, you know, as the old saying, water, water everywhere, not a drop to drink. We have heavy crude oil in Saudi Arabia and in other parts of the world. And it's and with one exception in 1973, one very short period of time, it's been available. The problem is the industry won't invest in converting that oil to the light products because it's very expensive and the profit's not there.
And because why should they? You say because drilling in the U.S. is the most profitable place drill. Why is that?
Well, if you look, I wrote the windfall profit tax in the Carter administration, mm-hmm. and I'm proud of it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at England, Mrs. Thatcher, not exactly a liberal leader, imposed very large taxes. You had a caller from Virginia talking about, are these people paying royalties? In England, if prices go up, most of the revenue goes to the government. Same thing's true in Norway. Norway gets roughly 75% of the revenue from oil production.
And in the USA?
It's about 15-20%. And so the oil companies really want to drill here. Now, this episode...
So once again, the upside is all for the company, and the downside, spill in the river.
It's the consumer. Yeah, it's in the river. Right, exactly right. And the thing is, actually what we see now is that the big companies sell their refineries. Shell has sold a third of its refineries, over 1.5 million barrels a day, rather than investing to produce the cleaner products, because if they delay the introduction of the refining upgrading equipment, they get higher crude prices and they make higher profits. So it really pays people to go ahead. Now, I will not apologize for any of these companies for their bad corporate citizenship. We're having a conference here at the Aspen Institute right now with utility people. And interestingly, over 40 years that I've been following this business, the utility executives have gone from being Neanderthal to being very forward-thinking. They're looking ahead, how can we use renewables and so on. Unfortunately, the oil industry is still populated, generally, in at least the big oil companies, by people who say, just let us drill, let us do whatever we want to do.
Let me get a caller right here, if I may. Dave in Stowe, Massachusetts. Dave, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks very much for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I work in energy conservation, renewable energy, and this conversation always frustrates me to no end. Although a lot of your callers have been talking about stuff that's very dear to me.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked a long time, me and my colleagues, that this is unnecessary, but I finally have a bit of news that I'd like to share with your readers.
Okay, okay.
Germany. As of a year ago, July 7, 2010, there's an article. If you Google Germany 100% renewable, their goal is to be 100% renewable by 2050.
Yeah, we talked about it for an hour about 3 weeks or 4 weeks ago, and they're not exactly in a sunny climb. It's sort of cloudy, and still they're really committed to doing this.
And the technology is there, and the hurdles that we've got to work on, such as it's not a baseload power source, these are all problems that can and will be solved versus Fukushima's, BP oil spills, mm-hmm. all this stuff. And I also have to integrate this with your speaker, Paul Gilding, who was on a few weeks ago.
Yes, from Australia. Mm-hmm.
You start putting all these things together, and the picture becomes clear. It's a limited planet. We need to work on a new economic system in some ways. And frankly, renewable energy, our energy supply is essentially infinite. It's the one resource that we have in infinite quantity. If we're intelligent, we don't have to damage the planet to use it.
Well, you're talking solar or wind or...
Solar, wind, biomass,
yeah, yeah.
These phenomenal sources that, yes, there are problems and, yes, they have impacts, but they pale in comparison to, Fukushima, BP oil spill,
Dave, we hear it loud and clear. Our time is short, but I'm so grateful for your call. Philip Verligo, what about it? Jim Jensen says the same thing. You've got an aging, big, but aging infrastructure out there for fossil fuels. You're going to have to make a big investment so you don't have more spills like what we see in the Yellowstone. He says don't make it there. Make it in alternative fuels. Make it in truly clean fuels. What about it, Philip?
He's absolutely right. We do need investments to produce the clean fuels for the transition. They don't have to be there, but we should be moving forward towards the clean fuels. The interesting thing is that there are a lot of small companies that are pushing ahead on alternative renewable fuels. I wouldn't go so far as to totally do away with hydrocarbons. I think we're going to need them. I push on natural gas, aside from because natural gas, if it's developed correctly, and of course the industry doesn't want to do it,
isn't doing it, many would say. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, is not doing it. You're right, is not doing it. Can provide a good transition. But yes, one needs to push harder, and one needs to encourage the renewables. And, you know, since I've been doing this now, I feel like an old man. We're finally beginning to get some movement on this after 30 years of saying we ought to do this. You know, Nixon's first energy message was 40 years ago in July,
yeah.
June, and nothing has happened, really.
And oil in the river on the Yellowstone. Alexis, I'll leave us with a reminder of what's at stake here. When there's no oil spill in the river, what's it like out along the banks of your farm there?
I think it's the best place in the world. That's why I moved back to Montana. And, you know, the president of the pipeline company, he met with us personally, and he said he was sorry for the inconvenience. And I just want people to know that nothing about this is inconvenient. It's a disaster. It's a disaster area. And I was really offended by that. So I just hope people keep watching this and watching the developments.
An inconvenience up against all that beauty and all that nature. And the Yellowstone name says a lot on that front. We will keep watching, Alexis, and we really appreciate your spending this time with us today. Good luck to you there with the farm and the cleanup. Sorry it happened. I hope it works out one way or another for you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks.
Philip Verliger with PK Verliger joining us today from Aspen, Colorado. Mr. Verliger, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, and I wish her the best. It's really beautiful there.
We all do. And Jim Jensen, Executive Director of the Montana Environmental Information Center, joining us from Helena, Montana. Thank you, Mr. Jensen, for being with us.
You're very welcome. Come visit us.
We will. Clean it up. Clean it up quick. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.